Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 and KJZZ.org. I'm Mark Brody, along with Steve Goldstein. Quick check of Valley traffic. 51 southbound, a crash at I-10 has the shoulder blocked. Mostly sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon. Look for a high of 95 today. Clear tonight, overnight lows in the mid-70s. Sunny for both tomorrow and Sunday with highs in the mid-90s. 96 tomorrow, 94 for a high on Sunday. It's sunny right now in Phoenix, 93 degrees.
If you want to vote in person before Election Day in Maricopa County, you have that opportunity starting October 12th. KJZZ's Jude Jaffe Block reports there are 25 early voting locations all voters can visit, though hours at the sites vary.
Early voting is for people who don't vote by mail and want to get voting out of the way early this year. Elizabeth Bartholomew is with the Maricopa County Recorder's Office. She says even though the county projects fewer people will vote in person this presidential election compared to last,
we have actually increased the number of early voting sites to make that more convenient for the voters.
25 sites, up from 15. Most locations are in city clerk's offices in cities around the valley. A full list is available on the recorder's website. While most sites are open weekdays 8 to 5, some are open Monday to Thursday from 7 to 6. Spencer Scharf of the Arizona Democratic Party says that schedule is better for people trying to vote before or after work, and more people would be able to vote early if the hours could be extended at more sites.
We just think that it would benefit the entire community if more early voting centers had extended weekday hours, and that in-person voting would be even more accessible than it is currently.
An analysis by the Arizona Democratic Party found sites with the 8 to 5 schedule tend to be in areas with large minority and Democratic populations. The recorder's office says hours are set by the city clerks. Jude Jaffe Block, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The new director of the Phoenix Veterans Affairs Healthcare System will officially start her post on Sunday. But as KJZZ's Carrie Young reports, the new appointment is receiving some criticism.
Rima Ann Nelson will be the healthcare system's seventh director in 3 years. Before coming to Phoenix, she was the director at the VA regional office in Manila, Philippines. Prior to that, she was the medical center director for the St. Louis VA. At issue is Nelson's record at these facilities. While in St. Louis, for example, the hospital had to temporarily halt surgical activity after inspections revealed insufficient equipment sterilization. Brandon Coleman is a VA whistleblower and now addiction therapist at a VA clinic in Cottonwood. He says the news is disappointing.
Could we think of anything else? I mean, they keep taking these bad apples, and instead of getting rid of them, they recirculate them.
In a statement, VA Deputy Secretary Sloan Gibson says he has full confidence Nelson will provide the sound leadership required to build on the progress the Phoenix system has made to improve access to care. But Arizona Congresswoman Kyrsten Sinema says she isn't so sure.
We deserve the very best to fix the absolute worst functioning VA in the country. And instead, we are being sent someone who has a checkered past.
On Friday, Sinema and Congressman Matt Salmon sent a letter to President Obama and VA Secretary Robert McDonald requesting this not become a permanent position until there's been a thorough analysis of Nelson's past. Carrie Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
This week brought a new development in the race for Maricopa County Sheriff. Sheriff Arpaio has been running ads that bring up an old accusation against his opponent Paul Penzone. KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins has been covering this. So, Jimmy, what is the latest?
We're seeing a repeat of campaign tactics used by Arpaio's campaign 4 years ago. In 2012, Arpaio ran ads against Penzone, accusing him of assaulting his ex-wife.
And that race turned out to be a lot closer than many expected, just 4 or 5 points.
Yeah, Arpaio won by just a few points, and that attack ad could have made the difference. So, you know, here we are 4 years later. Arpaio is now carrying the baggage of these potential criminal contempt of court charges. Polls are showing a tight race again. Some polls by the Democrats even have Penzone leading. So Arpaio rolled out the accusations again in a new ad.
And how did Penzone respond?
It seems like the Pinzone campaign saw this coming. They set up a website refuting the allegations. Pinzone even had his ex-wife sign an affidavit that calls the allegations of assault inaccurate. And then yesterday, Pinzone filed a lawsuit against Arpaio for defamation. Here's Pinzone reacting to the latest ad.
There's never been a time in my life where I've ever hurt, harmed any woman or child, including my former wife. So for someone to take advantage of a personal issue during a difficult time when two people went through a divorce and emotions were involved, but no violence was truly involved, to try to take advantage of that for their own political gain, I find to be one of the most unethical and irresponsible things to do.
That was Pinzone giving an emotional statement expressing his personal frustration, but his attorney, Jim Holland, says there are legal issues at stake as well.
The actions that Mr. Arpaio has engaged in constitute defamation and false light of an innocent family. But he did not engage in these actions unwittingly or unknowingly. The court documents themselves show that Mr. Arpaio should have known that Mr. Pinzone had never engaged in any form of domestic violence. In fact, this is the court record that has always been on record for more than 10 years when the divorce was filed, in which Mr. Pinzone's former wife said that there was no domestic violence that had occurred during the marriage.
Arpaio responded saying the ad is totally based on fact and the paperwork backs that up. Corey Langhofer is an attorney for Arpaio's campaign.
The fact of the matter is the Arpaio campaign has every right to look at police reports and court records to tell the public what they find in those records about Paul Pinzone. The First Amendment doesn't protect politicians from criticism. It guarantees that citizens will have the right to find out information about politicians and share it with others, regardless of how tawdry that might be, before citizens go to the ballot box to vote.
Pinzone has challenged Arpaio to make these allegations to his face in a debate, but none are scheduled, and Sheriff Joe has a history of avoiding debates.
Jimmy, it seems like the sheriff has chosen to have the debate in the press instead of at the podium.
And now Pinzone is taking it to court.
KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins. Jimmy, thanks.
My pleasure, Steve.
Libertarian presidential candidate Gary Johnson will be campaigning in Phoenix tomorrow with an afternoon rally scheduled at the Phoenix Airport Marriott. Polls here have shown Johnson, the former governor of New Mexico, tracking in the single digits. So what does he have to do to improve those numbers? To find out, I'm joined by Barry Hess. He was Arizona's Libertarian gubernatorial nominee several times and has run for other offices on the Libertarian ticket. So, Barry, what kind of message from a Libertarian Party nominee resonates here, both among party members and other voters?
Well, I think that we're all in this. It's more than just libertarians. It is Americans, and Arizonans in particular. But I think what he's got to get across is that he can stabilize the economy, he will lessen taxes, and he'll alleviate a lot of the oppressive rules and regulations and laws that now destroy what used to be the American ideal. I think he'll rein in government. And I say this because he's got a track record. He's got an 8-year track record as governor who was reelected as a Republican in a very Democrat state, and they love him over there. I mean, when you visit him and you walk down the street and people recognize Gary, they wave at Gary, and it's with more than one finger.
Is part of his challenge to convince voters that they, even if they agree with him, that a vote for him is not, you know, what some people consider, you know, a thrown away vote or a wasted vote?
Right. Well, you know, the wasted vote is the oldest myth in politics, is try to scare the like-minded out of representing their actual vote. In other words, they vote against their better interests in order to keep a candidate out.
As you were campaigning for governor and other offices as the Libertarian nominee in those races, what kinds of things did you hear from voters about why they maybe were or were not supporting you?
Well, I never really heard people telling me why they would not support me in terms of issues and platform and positions and all that kind of good stuff. But what I did hear was the concern that the old media was constantly telling them if they voted for anybody other than a Republican or Democrat, it wouldn't count. And that is a contrived condition.
One of the things that we consistently hear about Arizona is that as a state, as a group of residents, we all have this sort of libertarian bent to us. But when you look at
electoral results and you look at the polls that show Governor Johnson doing roughly as well here as he is in a lot of other states, I'm curious from your perspective, how libertarian is Arizona actually?
Well, I think that in their hearts, the Arizonans people are very, very libertarian. They love the ideals. But as far as Arizonans go, it is the scare tactic. The wasted vote is probably the biggest reason people don't realize they're wasting their vote with a Republican Democrat.
When you look at this election cycle, you look at a Libertarian nominee, Gary Johnson, who is from a neighboring state, from New Mexico. You have two major party candidates who have historic unfavorability ratings. They're historically not liked by many voters. And you have a state in Arizona, which traditionally has been seen as a libertarian type leaning place. Why isn't Gary Johnson doing better here?
It's publicity. That's what it comes down to.
On
just
his
like
part?
In the debates. No. He's been actually doing good. He's getting more publicity. No, it's the major media wanting to not mention his name. That's what it all comes down to. The people who see Gary and hear him are the people who will vote for him because they see something they like.
Does it concern you some of the attention that Governor Johnson has been getting recently for some of his, as he calls them, brain freezes?
Yeah. I get a kick out of that because if that's all the old media can come up with to criticize him for, I'm a libertarian. You ask me who a foreign leader is that I admire, I could not tell you one. Because as a libertarian, asking us to pick our favorite foreign leader is like asking a vegan how they want their steak. You know, it's crazy.
Barry Hess has been the Libertarian nominee for governor, among other offices here in Arizona. Barry, thank you very much.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much. Appreciate it, Mark.
Arizona's highway performance was in the top half nationally in 2012, according to a new report. The Reason Foundation's annual highway report ranks Arizona 19th in the country, although the state gets some very high and very low marks in specific categories. David Hartgen is the report's lead author and professor emeritus of transportation studies at UNC Charlotte, and he joins me. And David, let's start with the big picture. Overall, how are the nation's highways and other transportation infrastructure doing?
Well, actually, this might be surprising. We find that the infrastructure is actually in pretty good shape. I know it's common to hear that the infrastructure is crumbling, but in fact, the state-owned highway system, which is the higher-level highway system we have in this country, is actually in quite good shape. Most of the statistics show that it's improved slowly but steadily over the last couple of decades.
I want to ask you about a couple of the categories that Arizona scored very well in. One is the percentage of deficient bridges. Arizona does pretty well in that category. Also, the number of urban interstate miles in poor condition. Both of those categories Arizona scored very well in. To what do you attribute that?
Well, yes, you're right. Compared with other states, we scored Arizona third nationwide in the percentage of deficient bridges at only about 10%. And then for the urban interstate system, less than 1% of that system was rated in poor condition. There are a number of factors. One certainly would mention weather issues and climate issues. Most significant problems in our study are in those states that have significant changes in weather during the year, particularly freeze-thaw cycles where water gets into the pavement and then freezes and then softens later. Also, truck traffic, urbanization can affect these ratings as well. And, of course, these are all issues that most states don't have direct control over. It's just the hand that they're dealt, and they have to play it.
Do you think that the relative age of some of Arizona's infrastructure might have a role in this as well?
Well, certainly that would be the case. In the Northeast, for instance, most of the state-owned infrastructure is between 60 and 70 years old. And the newest parts are the interstate system, which are 40 or 50 years old. So Arizona would undoubtedly have a newer road system, particularly upgraded road system, than Northeast states. And, of course, the bad news from observing that is that 10 or 15 years from now, when Arizona's system deteriorates further, then it will be the old guy in town, and the other states will have repaired their roads by then.
Among the categories that Arizona did not fare so well in, fatality rates per 100 vehicle miles, urban, interstate, and freeway lane miles congested, these seem like things that drivers and residents would really take note of.
Well, they certainly do, and particularly commuting delays are an increasing problem around the country. And we scored Arizona 41st nationwide in terms of commute delays. Even though it has only one very large city, Arizona has other cities that have their congestion problems. And so it may come as a surprise to Arizonans that they're rated so low. The fatality rate is another issue. That's almost 40% higher than the national average and also rated 41st nationally. And that's an area where it's going to be also quite difficult to get the numbers down.
Both of those seem like they are at least somewhat related to driver behavior, whereas the categories in which Arizona was scored well are more about infrastructure, sort of age and climate, things that we don't really have much control over. Does that in any way impact how much the state can improve in some of those areas where it's struggling?
Well, it's certainly an opportunity there for the state to work with individual drivers, of course, and with driver associations and such groups to try to improve these factors. We mentioned earlier the age of the Arizona system compared with other states. It's probably going to be the case that as the Arizona system ages, that these numbers, which now appear favorable, for instance, on the condition of the pavement and the condition of bridges, they probably are going to tick downward as the system gets older. And so the roadside, if you will, side of the problem is going to rise in importance and require more attention from the responsible agencies.
David Hartgen is Professor Emeritus of Transportation Studies at UNC Charlotte and the lead author of the Reason Foundation's annual Highway Report. We'll post that study at theshow.kjzz.org.
It's the end of the first quarter for a lot of Valley schools, and Proposition 123 money has been parceled out to public districts. But where does that money go exactly? In our new series, Inside Arizona's Classroom, we'll follow along with teachers in public schools as they go through this school year. From KJZZ's West Valley Bureau, Casey Kuhn brings us our first story.
Good morning. Welcome to Mrs. Rainbow's class.
The kindergarten classroom in Rainbow Valley Elementary School is dark, and it's near the end of the school day. 20 or so children sit around a smart board while teacher Betalicia Reyna helps them play a game to learn English letters.
One more time, ready?
And when school's over, they sing. The student greeter and the song are techniques Raina uses to manage the classroom while helping her kids learn English. Her class is made up of only English language learners, most the children of local dairy workers. Rainbow Valley is in South Buckeye. It's a rural suburban school surrounded by dairies and cotton farms.
It's way out in the middle of the mountains, nowhere.
Last year, Raina went door to door in her community to try and convince voters to pass a bond override. It failed, and now the district is trying again this November, even after Prop 123 passed. She says it's an uphill battle because she feels the attitude toward education has shifted.
With all the politics and stuff going on and with all the budget cuts and everything that's going on, it makes it hard.
7% of kids in Arizona are English language learners, and almost all of them are elementary level. Raina is the only ELL kindergarten teacher at Rainbow Valley. She's always worked in Arizona, but says it certainly isn't easy.
It makes it feel like nobody values what you do, but I know that I make a difference.
It's the same attitude Tammy Dirksen, a teacher on the northwest side of Buckeye, takes with her second grade classroom.
Financially, it's very stressful. It's difficult. If I didn't love it, I would leave teaching because of that.
Dirksen has worked at Tartesso Elementary for 9 years, and her four sons have gone through the school system too.
Benjamin Dirksen, come to your mom's classroom.
It's Friday after school, and Dirksen is calling for her son Benjamin over the intercom. Prop 123 gave Dirksen her first significant pay raise, 4%, since she started. Raises are how most Arizona districts spent their Prop 123 money. Nationally, an average elementary teacher salary is $56,000. Arizona's average is $42,000, a third less. Dirksen says she often wants to get new classroom materials.
And then I'll remind myself, I can't. I'm a teacher. I have no money. I have four children.
Her advice to brand new teachers is to set boundaries, especially on spending your own money on classroom supplies.
This year alone, I think I've spent about $15,000 to $2,000 of my own money.
Tracy Irvin is a first-year teacher at Desert Oasis Elementary in the town of Whitman. She became a full-time teacher after subbing last year when a bond override failed to pass for the fourth year in a row.
So, boys and girls, it's my turn to speak because we need to raise our hands if we want to speak.
And Irvin says her hours planning can keep her away from her family.
When I get home, usually it's around 7:30, 8 o'clock, and my family, they're looking at me like, good night.
Arizona has a tough time getting fully certified teachers, which Irvin is still working on as she completes an internship program. Latest numbers show up to a quarter of open teaching positions were vacant at the end of August. Irvin stepped up to the plate when she saw a need at Desert Oasis, but knows she has a long way to go in learning how to be a full-time teacher.
I do love to do the job. I just wish it was a way that it would be a little less stress, you know, a little less work. But I guess this is welcome to teaching.
Raina, Dirksen, and Irvin all felt the same calling to grow young minds. Proposition 123 money will continue to be doled out for the next 9 years while schools face teacher shortages and those teachers face low salaries. Casey Kuhn, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
This was the first part of KJZZ's year-long series, Inside Arizona's Classrooms, and we want to hear from you. If you know a teacher or have a great education story, let us know on our Facebook page or go to kjzz.org.
Art and business have seemed like strange bedfellows over the years, but in the right situation, the combination can create beautiful music or paintings or poetry. Among many potential titles, Valley creative Leah Marche, who's a stage poet and storyteller, is a self-described arts entrepreneur. She's also one of Phoenix New Times' 100 creatives. And Leah, how would you define yourself as an arts entrepreneur?
I want to do it myself. I want to own my own business. I want to be in control, run things kind of thing. But when it's so connected to the arts, then it just merges well. Arts is business to me.
Okay.
Looked at as that.
Well, yeah. Talk about that a little bit more.
That's, a big gap that we have because we always want to keep arts over to the side. You know, it's this appendage or what have you. When it comes to STEM, you know, you have to force to get it to be STEAM, right? But no, it's part of everything. So we have to look at it as that way, as a business. And I think we can improve how we look at the arts when we put it on that same line.
How much of what you do as a storyteller, as a poet, as an entrepreneur is about challenging the status quo?
I think that's what you have to do. I think that's what all of us have to do.
All of us as artists or all of us as people?
All of us as people. Okay. Artists maybe more so, right? I think for me, I'm always trying to look, okay, how can I be different, right? Just from within the arts field, like if someone else is doing something, well, I need it to be different. Or I want to, you know, how can I find a twist to that? But in terms of status quo, as an artist, I like the quote from Nina Simone, who says, you know, artist's duty is to reflect the times. So however you have to do that and to share your voice and to make sure that you're making a meaningful impact with when you say you're going to be an artist and that you're going to put something out there to the world that people are going to take in and they're either going to benefit from it, they're either going to disagree or agree. But yeah, you have to look at it that you are trying to be controversial, you're trying to stir things up, you're trying to get people to think and ultimately to act on something.
Is art not doing its job if it's not thought-provoking?
I would say so. I mean, there's a spectrum. I mean, you can have something that's frivolous or just be fun or what have you, but I think at the end of the day, you have to be making sure you're making an impact, that you're reaching someone, you're allowing them to have a different perspective or just to know your story, to kind of get into your world. And yeah, it's all about that connection. It's about that story. And ultimately, we find that we're all, you know, we have some similarities or what have you. But, you know, even if we don't agree, we can agree that you have a voice, you have a story. I should be able to listen to that and maybe learn from it and grow in a different way that is unexpected.
Is this a good community as far as being inspirational to other artists? Is this a real giving community when it comes to that? And has that changed? I mean, you're a native here. Have you seen that change?
I think so. And I can give you an example. As a co-founder of Black Poet Ventures, and that was in 2005. And the reason that came about was because within the Black poets in that community, there was a lot of kind of dissension. There was, you know, everyone was doing a lot of different things, but maybe there's some envy or some, you know, like, well, why are you doing that? Or how come you got that gig, or those types of things. And so me, I was not a poet. I was a journalist, you know, or am a journalist. I was a writer. So I would just go to these events and I want to cover them and interview these artists. And so I would go to everybody's thing, right? So I, you know, had a group of cohorts and I was like, well, and they were poets. And I was like, well, why can't y'all get along? I mean, like, what's the problem? Like, what is it that's not happening or that you have? So from that, our whole objective as we were building it is that how do we get people to collaborate, to come together, to share their art because they're all similar, and to do something that's positive for the community as a group. Can there be improvement? Always. But I think that we are doing a good job as a community to make sure that we are cross promoting, cross networking, and doing and just supporting one another.
How much of your message is one of reflecting the times? How much of it is what's going on inside you? Because obviously what goes on inside us is affected by the greater world, but there's also that internal voice that we all have.
Well, yeah, I think it's always first from within, right? You have to look at how you are in the middle of it, and then get your perspective that's out there. How does it affect you first, you know, before you can say, okay, what can I say? But I think for me, I'm thinking of that when I'm creating. Because I'm not only is it for me, but someone's going to listen to this, someone's going to read it, you know, down the line or what have you. So then I need to make sure that whatever it is I'm putting out there, that it's, you know, something that is beneficial to the world.
In what ways has it mattered to your art to be an African-American woman?
It's who I am.
Right.
You can only be what you know. Mm-hmm. You know, you can only put out there. But, you know, so, yeah, a lot of that is my story. But then at the same time, I'm a human being, right? And you look at those universal truths that we all can share. So you come from that perspective. But my voice, yes, is a Black perspective. It is a female perspective. So that's going to be in there. You can't help it.
Well, Leah Marche, great to meet you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Leah Marche is a poet, storyteller, and self-described arts entrepreneur, and one of Phoenix New Times' 100 Creatives. You can hear our other conversations with creatives online at theshow.kjzz.org. It's The Show on 91.5. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And with The Takeaways, John Hockenberry, I'm Mark Brody. A grand moment in history is passing this weekend in the nation of Colombia.
The government of Colombia and the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, known as FARC, have signed a peace agreement that puts an end to the five-decade war that has claimed more than 200,000 lives.
But the agreement for now is only symbolic. It will become official or will be rejected after Colombians vote on a crucial referendum this Sunday. Nadja Drost is a Bogota-based reporter on assignment for the PBS NewsHour. She was at the peace signing on Monday and has been traveling the country this week, tracking the reaction and anticipation of voters all over the nation of Colombia. Nadja, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Hello, thank you.
How important is this milestone for Colombia moving away from something that's really, for decades, dogged the politics and identity of this nation?
Well, actually, it really feels like it's everything right now. I think that a lot of people have, from outside of Colombia, have seen that it's been an interesting and perhaps unusual move for President Santos to call these peace agreements into question and using a national plebiscite or referendum. But he has always said that he has wanted to get the confidence and support from the public. And that would help ensure that these peace agreements are implemented when his presidency ends and whoever replaces him in the future. So I think that it's kind of a very important moment for Colombians to take stock of what the past 4 years of negotiations in Cuba have come to, and to really decide, do they want peace to happen? Do they want this war to end? But ultimately, the real question is, are they willing to pay the costs for peace? Because, of course, this peace agreement is not perfect. For most Colombians, there are shortfalls. And the question that a lot of people are asking themselves is, am I willing to accept the peace agreement as it is and live with whatever shortfalls it has?
Is there any chance that this is a high stakes, you know, gambit that will turn out like the Brexit vote in the UK?
Well, right now, polls are showing that the yes side, which is the campaign that votes in favor of accepting the peace agreements, are comfortably ahead. However, there is a significant population in Colombia that still has not decided how they're going to vote, if they're going to vote in favor or rejection of the peace agreements. And so that population is in limbo right now and may possibly swing the vote.
If this vote is a mandate, an overwhelming yes on Sunday, what will Colombians be able to do, think about as far as the future goes, that they haven't been able to think about in the past?
I think if these peace agreements are implemented, I think that Colombians will be able to start thinking about parts of their life that one might not think is, you know, inextricably linked with conflict necessarily. These peace agreements are very wide-ranging. They don't necessarily just touch on issues of hostilities between parties and disarmament. They deal with a lot of the root causes of the conflict and work on trying to improve rural development and address a lot of the inequalities that are both a root cause as well as a consequence of the conflict. So a lot of Colombians are seeing these peace agreements not simply as a way for warring parties to put down arms and cease hostilities, but rather a milestone into a different possible era for Colombia where a lot of those inequalities are addressed.
Are there individuals in Colombia who are bitter about this being viewed as an amnesty for the FARC, the armed militants?
Absolutely. There is a significant population in Colombia which sees that this peace agreement is a way of handing over amnesties that are not necessarily deserved to the FARC. This sentiment has largely been led by ex-president Alvaro Uribe, who has been leading the campaign of no to reject the peace accords. And some of the kind of touchstone issues that the no campaign has really been focusing on is this idea that the peace agreements are not harsh enough for the FARC, that they do not adequately address the atrocities that many FARC members and the organization as a whole has committed. The problem is that both the FARC and the government have said that if this referendum fails, there is no way that they will return to the negotiating table.
Nadia Drost is in Colombia. She's a Bogota-based reporter on assignment for PBS NewsHour. She was talking to The Takeaway's John Hockenberry. It's the show. There are going to be a lot of efforts between now and November 8th to try to get you to vote, but most of them probably won't be as colorful or graphic as the one at the Arizona Capitol Museum. That's where more than 40 posters urge visitors, sometimes subtly, sometimes less so, to cast their ballots this November. The exhibit is called Get Out the Vote, an exhibition of design for civic engagement, and it's the work of AIGA, the Professional Organization for Design. I met Liz Magura at the exhibit. She's president of AIGA Arizona, and standing in front of the posters, I asked her what about them stands out to her, both graphically and in text.
I think a lot of them bring out quite a bit of emotion from, you know, just the typography of the word vote to some of the illustration that you'll see in these posters to, you know, the color scheme. Some of them have gone with red, white, and blue. Some of them are very neutral. Some of them have really bright and loud colors. So the variety makes for an amazing exhibition and for each individual walking through here to really spend a couple of moments to really, you know, look at the graphics that are being presented on just each poster individually.
From your perspective as an artist, what to you is sort of the most effective way to get out this message? Because this is a very specific message. This is telling people to vote. So in your mind, if you were designing one of these, how would you go about trying to get that message across?
Gosh, that's such a hard question. So I guess I've been passionate about voting since I was able to vote. I think creating something like this, it takes really bringing your passion around voting into it and creating a message that you think is going to be special to you to potentially push that onto people and see, you know, like, this is how I feel about it. So I think it's a really personal way to just express yourself around this type of thing.
What do you think is the role of artists and graphic artists in trying to convince people to vote?
I think designers and graphic artists have a really powerful way to share the message that around voting awareness, and we can do so artistically and visually to really, I guess you could talk about it all you want, but when you see something that actually makes an impact on the way you think about voting, I think it could really, you know, encourage you if you're not voting or don't know who to vote for, but still these posters present a way to encourage you to vote, and hopefully something sticks out to where, you know, oh, this is my country, this is something that I really need to do, and drive that person to the polls.
There's a poster right in front of us that says, it's not about who is loudest, it's about who votes. One down there says, the ballot is stronger than the bullet. It sounds like these are really almost like ad campaigns trying to get people to take action on something.
Definitely. So you bring up a good point, like taking action. And again, I think it goes back to empowering our communities and our country to register to vote and to understand that it takes all of us to make the decision, whatever the decision becomes. But you hear a lot of people complaining when, you know, something isn't what they want, but it's like, well, did you vote? Did you actually, you know, take action and speak up? So I think in terms of some of the language on these posters, they can really jump out at a person to, again, go to the polls or register to vote.
Is it the kind of thing where you almost in some way have to shock somebody into like, oh yeah, this is something I should do?
Yeah, I think that's definitely a great message to be creative like that, to really bring out, you know, those words and go beyond just vote. And I guess there's a couple ways that you could visually show this, whether it is the words vote in some sort of illustration or way to really show voting in a creative way versus, like you said, the campaign of bringing out something really shocking or maybe provocative or something to really get in people's heads or make it memorable. Like, I saw this poster and it really spoke to me. I should go to the polls and vote or register.
Artists forever, basically, have been involved in politics in some way or another. In your mind, how has the role of the artist and the graphic designer evolved over time to the point where we're here now?
Sure. I think the get out the vote campaign is really powerful because a lot of times it seems like designers may take a back seat or, you know, want to be completely neutral about the whole thing. But I think the Get Out the Vote campaign is a really great way to just, you know, play a part, encourage voting. It doesn't matter who you're voting for, but just be a part of the country and do your civic duty and vote.
Liz Magura is the president of AIGA Arizona, the local chapter of the Professional Organization for Design. The exhibit, called Get Out the Vote, an exhibition of design for civic engagement, will be on display at the Arizona Capitol Museum through November 30th.
Imagine you wake up one day and suddenly can't smell anything. No perfume, no flowers, no chocolate chip cookies baking in the oven, nothing. And this isn't a stuffed nose. This is like the on-off switch in your brain has been flipped. Doctors can prescribe steroids or nasal sprays, and surgery is sometimes an option. But for many patients, a lack of smell lingers for months, often years. From our partners at WHYY's The Pulse, Todd Bookman caught wind of a new technique that relies on the brain relearning how to smell.
She's become something of a poster child for people with this condition.
My name is Chris Kelly, and I am a person who lost their sense of smell after a virus. I'm called an anosmic.
Straight-backed and tall, Kelly, who was born in Maine and now lives in the UK, lost her ability to smell in 2012. She caught a cold, it moved into her sinuses, and then she woke up and it was just gone.
I opened my eyes, I went into the bathroom, I uncapped the toothpaste, and was immediately aware that I couldn't smell anything.
Colds and other viruses are a common cause of anosmia, but it can also be brought on by a brain injury or from nasal polyps. Aging is another factor. different parts of the olfactory system, the receptors, or the nerve simply stop working. And as quickly as it's lost, some people will spontaneously recover their ability to smell. But not Chris Kelly. She sought medical treatment, tried steroids, still nothing.
The most poignant loss for me was the loss of the smell of my children. And, you know, my children are grown now, but when I put my arms around them, I could easily recognize their smell.
Kelly says it was like every facet of her life lost a dimension. Today, though, much of her ability to smell is restored.
Can you hear me now?
Yes,
good.
Sir.
Right. Well, thank you very much.
Kelly is here at the Monell Chemical Senses Center in Philadelphia, where she's leading a workshop in something called smell training. She's not a doctor, but she is an evangelist for this type of anosmia treatment.
It started out as this thing that was a chore, like flossing my teeth, and it's ended as a kind of an altered awareness.
The smell training concept is simple. Even if you can't smell anything, anosmics need to keep trying and do so in a mindful way. Spend a few minutes in the morning, again in the evening, sniffing deeply. The repeated exposure and concentration may eventually yield results, but don't expect overnight success. It can take months, even longer.
I'm not getting anything out of lavender at all. Could you smell lavender?
Mary Beth James lost her ability to smell after being hit by a car. She's here at the workshop because it's been 4 years with very few gains made.
Lavender is a no. I'm not getting that one.
Scattered in front of Mary Beth and all the other attendees are vials of essential oils, potent little jars of concentrated lavender, as well as rose, eucalyptus, lemon, and clove. There are no hard rules for what you should smell, but those are the scents recommended by Thomas Hummel, a German ear, nose, and throat doctor and a guru of modern smell training. He's published studies showing it can work, especially for anosmics who start soon after the injury. That hope has Kenneth Lee digging his nose deep into the rose oil, dreaming of just a whiff.
You know, if you go to garden, I like gardening, but you don't smell any flowers, so...
Lee is just the saddest gardener in the world. And since flavor and smell are so closely linked, he's also lost the pleasure of eating. For many anosmics, everything tastes rubbery and beige. Edmund Probitkin is an ENT doc at Thomas Jefferson University Hospital, where he prescribes smell training to his patients. He says the condition can be devastating.
Smell affects so much of what we experience. It is such a potent sense. It really adds so much joy to life. And to lose it is really difficult. Folks become depressed. Folks have all kinds of problems.
So has anyone taken a break that wanted to? Anyone want to air out their nose by going outside? No.
Exactly how smell training can refresh the sense of smell isn't totally understood. But as Chris Kelly works the room, she tells people to treat it like they would physical therapy after an injury or a stroke. With no other options, Mary Beth James is willing to give the little vials of scented oil a chance.
You know, I want to be able to smell the turkey on Thanksgiving and the bread that I bake and the Christmas tree. So I'm giving it a shot. Why not?
Why not? She says even a bad aroma would be better than none at all. I'm Todd Bookman.
That story comes from our partners at the health and science show The Pulse. The podcast is on iTunes.
And in KJZZ News, the Attorney General's office will not order Secretary of State Michelle Reagan to give voters an extra day to register. As KJZZ's Phil Latzman reports, that's despite the fact the final day lands on a holiday.
The deadline this year is a week from Monday, October the 10th, which is Columbus Day, a state holiday. Reagan has told county election officials it does not matter, the deadline still applies. But House Minority Leader Eric Meyer, a Democrat, asked the Attorney General's office to intercede, citing a state law that says deadlines are moved back if they fall on a holiday.
She's chosen to potentially reduce voter participation when you would think it would be her job to encourage as many voters to participate in the electoral process as possible, particularly in a presidential election that's coming up.
Secretary of State spokesman Matt Roberts says Meyer is making a big deal out of nothing.
14 of the 15 counties are going to be open for voter registration. We knew that. Service Arizona, where most of our registration information comes from to begin with, is, of course, online.
The law requires requests to be postmarked by the October 10th deadline, but the post office will be closed that day. Phil Latzman, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And now it's time for The Quiz Show.
That's when we bring back Leszek Pawlowicz, our resident quiz master, who's won a Jeopardy! Tournament of Champions. Each time he's on, he'll play one of us in a game of trivia, hosted by our producer, Sarah Ventry. This week, he's playing KJZZ's Lauren Gilger. Last week, we gave you a puzzle to solve and randomly selected two entries. The puzzle was...
Now listen closely. If you have me, you want to share me. If you share me, you haven't gotten me. What am I? The answer is, of course, a secret. Our randomly selected winners this week are Fiona Dillon and Jessica Larson. Leszek will play on behalf of Fiona. Lauren will play on behalf of Jessica. Whoever wins will get a special KJZZ item.
Recently, the winners of the Ig Nobel Awards were announced. These are awards given for achievements that make people laugh and then think. Which of the following was not a project that received an actual award? Studies of the effects of wearing polyester, cotton, or wool trousers on the sex life of rats and similar tests with human males. A study that measured the amount of time people spent on roller coasters throughout their lives to determine if blondes really do have more fun. Or a scholarly study titled, quote, On the Reception and Detection of Pseudo-Profound Bullshit.
I was lucky enough to read an article about that this morning. So the second one is the one that did not win an Ig Nobel Prize.
You are correct. Why were you reading this?
Ig Nobels are important, man.
All right. Well.
Oh yeah. There was another. It was a great one. That was a paper on the personality of rocks.
I did see that one. Now we know you're keeping up with all the news. Mm-hmm. All right, Lauren.
I'm feeling even more insecure now.
A new study published in Current Biology analyzed the remains of an extinct reptile that lived 230 million years before the dinosaurs. This study found that this reptile had many of the traits that are found in dinosaurs, and therefore shows a scientific phenomenon known as evolutionary convergence, which is where organisms that are not related evolve similar traits. What is the name of the reptile? Is it Trioptychus primus, Reptilius antiqua, or Cryptolithus tessellatus? I made up two of those names.
Okay, well, to me, they sound a lot like characters like Optimus Prime. So let's see. How about using my non-Latin skills? I will say B is the answer.
It's actually A.
What?
I know.
That was the one that sounded the most fake.
Oh, that's the most real.
Yeah. Lauren, I would have picked the same one.
Good. That makes me feel better. Thank you.
Oh, that makes me feel great. Actually, I didn't make up Cryptolithus tessellatus. That's real, but it's not this
name. Not this, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, Trioptychus primus means the first of three eyes. It's got this weird little thing that kind of looks like a third eye.
Huh. Okay, cool.
I know. Cray. Who'd have thunk?
Who'd have thunk is right.
Leszek, are you big into astrology?
I'm big into the real science of astronomy, but I know a little bit about astrology.
What's your sign?
Well, I can go into the long explanation of why it's either Virgo or Leo, but we'll skip that for now.
So, which do you identify as?
Personally, I'd prefer Leo, but in my real life, I'm probably closer to Virgo.
Huh, what about you, Lauren?
I'm a Libra.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Me too.
Ah.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, Leszek, the internets have been in an uproar lately because NASA announced that the constellations are not in the same position they were before. And the organization also talked about a 13th astrological sign, which led some followers of astrology to freak out because this would mean that their sign isn't really their sign. NASA then posted on Tumblr clarifying that they didn't actually change your zodiac calendar and that they study astronomy, not astrology. What is the name of the 13th astrological sign that is in dispute? Is it Belita, Galatius, or Ophiuchus?
It is Ophiuchus, the serpent bearer.
That is correct. How did you know that one?
I got a undergraduate degree in astronomy. I have a telescope, and I go out in the skies all the time. Yeah, Ophiuchus is right next to Scorpius, I believe.
Wow. Well, that is accurate, and at the time of writing that question, I forgot about your degree. So. All right, Lauren, okay. No pressure, but you have to get this one right to stay in the game.
Oh, man. Okay, okay.
Okay. Lauren, what baseball team is suing, along with the MLB, vendors who are allegedly selling counterfeit and trademark-infringing merchandise? Is it the Red Sox, the Cubs, or the Yankees?
I would guess, just because of who they are, that this would be the Yankees.
You would think that the Yankees would do this?
Yes.
It's actually the Cubs.
No! My grandpa was a huge Cubs fan. He would be so disappointed in me. Oh.
Well, at least you're not selling counterfeit merchandise.
I'm not. That's
so it's
true.
Okay. Wow, Leszek, that is a comeback for you.
Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you, Lauren.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.